Esther 3, verses 7 through 9. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. Their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore, it is not for the king's prophet to suffer them. If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. We've seen already that Haman has been advanced into the court of Ahasuerus to a place of great prominence and influence. In fact, his elevation is marked by him being set in a seat which appears to be above all of the princes of the royal court. And there may well be a reason for that that we'll address in a few moments. And yet, such is the thirst for his power, like all covetousness, that's really what this is, that he could not find contentment in achieving such a high position. The reason is covetousness is insatiable. It has no limits. It is an appetite that cannot be satisfied. And thus, Haman continues to do all that he can to consolidate his power in the court of the king. Now, as he walks to and fro, we're told that the other courtiers would bow before him and they would reverence him. That was the king's command, by the way. They would feed his pride and they would stroke his ego as he was going in and out. Their subservience was itself a positioning of themselves on their own parts for greater security and prestige within the court. That's why they're obeying. That's why men obey the ridiculous laws of other men. So it was that, like all creatures of court, they actually began to grumble among themselves when they noticed that Mordecai didn't share in their fawning over that wicked ruler Haman. In fact, it was their chatter, most likely, as they sort of complained among themselves, that eventually brought Mordecai to Haman's attention. At some point, someone decided that enough was enough, and when Mordecai didn't give the answer they wanted, then Haman needed to know. And how did Haman respond? Did he respond as someone who was aware of the great dignity and the great responsibility that had been bestowed upon him? Not really. Instead, like so many others who are filled with an overconfident sense of self-worth, the fact is, Haman didn't even initially notice that Mordecai wasn't bowing. He was too taken up with the overwhelming scene of multitudes of courtiers bowing and giving reverence as he passed by. He wasn't concerned about that one guy over there in a corner, perhaps, maybe not so much in a corner. However, precisely because he has this overconfidence when it comes to his sense of self-worth, once his attention has been called to Mordecai, it's notable that the rest of the fawning crowd does not outweigh the presence of one man who will not bow. All of a sudden, his attention is moved from the crowds that are bowing and fawning before him to this one man that refuses to bow. Because Mordecai's defiance erases all of the satisfaction that he might have derived from the compliance of all the others. And the only way he could do that is that Haman was not actually content with his estate. He was insatiable in his quest for power. So it demonstrates the lust or the covetousness that is characterizing Haman here, that he would react in this way. I think before we go much further into our text, it is important to remember at this point that Haman was almost certainly a very religious man in his own way. His name is, as I told you several weeks ago, his name means gift of him or gift of the moon. And in all likelihood, he was descended from a priestly line, which would make him a priest. Because the Persians, like so many of the other Gentile peoples, they understood priesthood to run through family lines. And so if his father was a priest, then Haman himself would be a priest. And his name indicates that, in fact, he may well have been in this priestly line. And moreover, it's thought that he was in some degree connected with those religious people whom the Greeks and the Romans called magi. And that's important for a number of reasons here, as we're going to see. His elevation, then, in the court of Ahasuerus may well, and I think probably does represent, the ascent of a particular form of paganism that will, if it's left unchecked in the king's court, blunt whatever influence Esther and true religion will have in that royal court. So in this story, Haman, being magi, stands as a form of state religion in opposition to the true religion of Christ. And for this reason, he strikes not merely at Mordecai for not bowing, but he's going to strike at all of the Jews. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. But had he simply been a secular figure, he might have wished for the extinction of Mordecai's whole family. But that's not what he's seeking. And I think the reason is, as a chief representative of the Persian religion, now situated at the top of the Persian court, he would rather see the entire destruction of the Jewish religion, and that means destroying all of the Jews. Now, I've noted that our text calls Haman an Agagite. And it does so to tie him to the ancient enemies of God's people, Agag. But this is the result. Calling him this is probably not so much that he is actually a descendant of Agag, although this sets up a very important contrast. It probably results from the author of the book noticing a similarity between Haman's Persian title, which would be Goageh in Hebrew. That connotes a man of authority or a man of dignity. And if you were to look at it in Hebrew, it actually has a similarity to the name of the Amalekite king Agag, Agagi. The Persian title, Goageh, means a fellow comrade. And later on, the Jews at a later time use a Hebrew word, chavar, which means the same thing, to denote someone who is a magus, or member of the magi class, or fire priest. Now, this word in Hebrew means a companion, a fellow disciple, a comrade. And it came to signify a wise man or learned master. Remember the magi in Matthew's gospel. They're remembered as the three wise men from the east. So the surname, distorted in Hebrew to an Agagite, identified Haman as a member of those who were fire worshippers, magi. Now, in Isaiah 47, 9-13, this Hebrew word, chavar, Kavarim, is used several times to connote enchantments. These were then a separate group, these people, these magi, occupying the position of what have been called prognosticators, astrologers, and Chaldeans, who represent the spiritual caste or strata of the heathen society. And it was, in fact, descendants of these magi who would see the star and who would bring presents or gifts to Jesus in Bethlehem in Matthew 2. So it appears that Haman was a member of the priestly caste of astrologers and fire worshippers, part of a religion that was actually in diametrical opposition to the true religion that was held by the Jews. Mordecai's defiance was not then for Haman simply a civil defiance, though it was that too. But Mordecai's defiance was more importantly for Haman an act of subversion against the establishing of the Magi in the court of the king. That's at least how he probably read that. It may well be that Ahasuerus, Xerxes in profane history, that he had come to believe that his setbacks domestically, in the matter of Vashti, and if you remember some of the things I've mentioned, his prosecution of foreign wars, particularly his wars with the Greeks, these setbacks, these defeats, were due to a lack of proper religious counsel before he took action. It would have been very common at that time for those who were in positions of power in heathen governments to take counsel from these kinds of stargazers, prognosticators, astrologers, and so on. Whatever the case, Haman is now quite high in the estimation of the king, and he's in a position able to wield a certain amount of power over the court, and presumably then over the general population of the Persian Empire. Finally, as Haman contemplates the presence of Mordecai and tries to devise a way to exact revenge, he, unlike the king Ahasuerus, he begins his course of taking action with a kind of petitioning of the gods for favor. That's what's going on here in verse 7. He's seeking the proper method and means of eradicating the entire Jewish population. But you see, he, coming from this religious caste, is one who places an immense amount of trust in his religion for giving him guidance going forward. And like so many of the deluded heathens throughout the history of the world, Haman actually proceeds with the conceit that heaven is on his side. And that's going to be his undoing here. So in verse 7, in the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. In the first month, that is the month Nisan. Now, this numbering that our author uses does a couple of things. First, it fixes the exact month in the minds of the initial audience. It's the first month, which they would have known as Aviv. But since their return from the Babylonian captivity, the Jews had assumed the Babylonian names for all of their months. So they had renamed all of their months, having spent that time in Babylon. Now, our author, by reckoning the months using Babylonian names, he's reminding his audience of the great sin, their idolatry, which had brought them into that captivity. However, by noting its number, the number of the month, it also allows them to recall a time before their captivity when they were more faithful. Right? So by mentioning the number, he's giving them that space to recall the actual Jewish name of the month. But he's going to call it by the Babylonian name because he wants them to be mindful of why it is they're in this predicament or why it is this is coming upon them. And so by noting its number, he allows them to recall a time before their captivity when they're more faithful. Now, it is the remembrance of that from which they were fallen that actually holds forth to them a hope of recovery. Because it was at that time when they still held the promises of God by faith that would form the focus of their repentance and hope. That's why, for example, in Revelation 2:5, Christ says to one of the churches in Revelation, remember therefore from whence thou art fallen and repent and do the first works, or else I will come unto thee quickly and will remove thy candlestick out of his place except thou repent. He's reminding them that they need to go back. They need to consider what it is from which they've fallen. If they're going to repent, if they're going to do that which is works meet for repentance, they have to do so in terms of that which was actually faithful in its time. So they have to think about what is it from which they've fallen. They have to remember their faithfulness and the faithfulness of God and the attainments they had had in reform before God. They need to return to that. So numbering it the first month really is calling them to think about that, to think about that from which they had fallen. There's another reason, I think, for noting that this is the first month. And that is to help emphasize the nature of the action which is under consideration. So it has that first effect, but it also is calling attention to what's really going on here. In the presence of Haman, and with his keen attention, we're seeing here in this verse that the prognosticators are prognosticating. Right? According to their astrological calculations, all results must of casting lots, as we're going to see, must be interpreted with reference to the month and day of the year. Now that's astrological. Right? It's because of the fortune telling that is being undertaken that the days and months of the year are of particular and peculiar interest here. Moreover, according to astrologers, the first month is always that in which the sun enters the zodiacal sign of Varak or Aries, the ram. That's where the year begins. It begins with the vernal or spring equinox. Okay, it's Varak, Aries, the ram. Okay, the ram is a symbol then for the month Nisan. And it corresponds to our mid-March to mid-April. By the way, for the Jews, Nisan is the month in which they held Passover. And what did they do in Passover? They would slay a ram. Right? And that is a type of Christ who is the lamb slain from the foundation. There's a ram in the thicket when Abram is offering up Isaac. And so there is something the Jews think to this astrology, even though they're forbidden. If you're a heathen magi, then, if you're one of these heathen magus, I should say, magi is plural, if you're trying to cast fortunes to ascertain the future, the fact is the beginning of the new year is considered the most proper time to do so. And so that's when they're doing it. We don't really know how much time has passed between Haman taking note of Mordecai's obstinance and refusal to bow down and reverence him, and this casting of lots. But we see that he's clearly waited, whether it was a long time or short time, we don't know, but he's clearly waiting until the beginning of the year, and he's doing that precisely because they believed this was the best time to get the most accurate information concerning the future, the events of the coming year. All right. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of Ahasuerus. Now, the 12th year of Ahasuerus is regal reckoning of years. I've talked about this before. It was very common to number the years according to the reign of this king or that king. You would refer to the year of the reign of such and such a king. And in fact, that's what we do in our reckoning. Anno Domini, Christ is our king, and so we reckon that we are in the year 2017 of his reign. We're actually using regal years. We don't think of it that way, perhaps because of the secularizing of the last century or so. But that is, in fact, what we're doing. We're using this concept of regal reckoning of years, but we just have reference to a much higher king. Now, this 12th year, then, if we would recall chapter 2, verse 16, that was in the 7th year of Ahasuerus, Esther was made queen. This means that this is the 5th year after Esther had been made queen. And that would bring us to right around the year 474 BC. So, a few years had passed between the discovery of the plot against the king by Esther through her uncle Mordecai. And she's faded from view, and and Haman, in the interim, has been advanced to power. Okay. If you're a true believer, this has been a reversal then. If you've been watching this unfold, it seems like there's a reversal of a number of things that had previously raised your hopes for the prospects of the people of God. You can't help but look at this and think that it seems like everything all of a sudden is, maybe not all of a sudden, but everything is running in reverse. Yet there's a sense in the text that there's a greater purpose being wrought here. The author of Esther moves from the 7th to the 12th year without any attention to the intervening years, precisely because those years, while they do serve the providence of God, they don't serve the purpose or intent of the author telling us this story directly. Right. This story is being told to help us see the all-encompassing and directing hand of God that claims our attention, or should claim our attention. So the story of Esther is fashioned actually to touch the most prominent peaks of this providence in order to allow the audience, those who are reading and hearing the book of Esther read, to see that history really is, as some have said, his story. It is the story of the providence of God and Christ. Scripture then gives us the most important perspective, that of the divine, through which every other perspective has to be made to bend if we would perceive the true significance. And that's what Esther's book is doing. In the first month, that is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, the lot. Now, there are a number of ways in which the lot was cast. The word Pur is actually a loan word from the Akkadian Peru. Right, supposed to be Old Persian. And it is connected with more modern Persian word, pare. The Latin would be pars, the Greek meros or moira. All of which carry the notion of dividing or allotting parts. Parse. Latin is parse. We talk about parsing a verb. We're dividing it into its parts. When we parse, we part it. Meros in Greek, the same idea there of parts. Right, lots were drawn or thrown in various ways. Sometimes they were thrown by means of dice. Sometimes they used slips of wood or strips of parchment or paper. Sometimes they threw down arrows. And there is an Arabic word that has that connotation, much related to this. There are a lot of different ways in which lots could be cast, you know, drawing of straws, things like that. The Hebrew word that's used here, geral, connotes the casting of stones. And that word is actually very much related to an Arabic word that in its various forms refers to small stones, stony ground, or something that's just stony. And so there's more of an idea in the Hebrew mind, at least, of the throwing of stones or the casting of dice, something of that sort. At least that's the connotation that we can derive from the Hebrew word. Now, it was, as I've indicated earlier, it was a great part of heathen superstition to cast their lots before they undertook anything of great purpose. And, as I mentioned, it might have been thought to be the source of the disaster in the earlier courses of the king, that he evidently didn't begin any of the things he did with the casting of lots. It's not mentioned. It doesn't, and we would think in terms of where Esther is taking us in the story, that had he done this, had a lot been used earlier in the story, and figuring as prominently as it does in the Feast of Purim, that it would have been mentioned had they done it. But it appears that they didn't. And so, now we have Haman, the elevated pagan fire worshiper, member of the caste of the Magi, concluding that he needs some supernatural help if he's going to bring about the destruction of the Jews. Now, before we go any further, I think it's important to understand this. The intuition that there's something divine in the lot is not wrong. I know that's using the passive voice when I say that. But it is not wrong. In other words, it's right. They're correct in that. But I don't really want to say it's right in a definitive sense because it's the Magi who are doing this. They're heathens who are doing it. The Jews themselves, however, believe that it revealed something in the will of God. It's in Proverbs 16:33. The lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. So they knew that there was something of God. Indeed, the misuse of the lot was and has always been viewed by believers, professors of the true religion, to be a violation of the third commandment concerning not taking God's name in vain. Casting of the lots, whether it's by cutting of cards, casting of dice, anything that involves what we might call an element of chance, it's calling upon God for a revelation of his will in certain circumscribed circumstances or situations. And that's okay sometimes. It's just not okay when it's done frivolously. But for example, in Numbers 26, 55 and 56, notwithstanding, the land shall be divided by lot according to the name of the tribes of their fathers. They shall inherit. According to the lot shall the possession thereof be divided between many and few. See, the lot is dividing, it's allotting, it's parting. In Proverbs 18:18, the lot causeth contentions to cease and parteth between the mighty. So it's The casting of lots then defined parts or boundaries and creates what you might think of as a map of reconciliation between contending parties. And it's doing so by revealing the providence of God in an extraordinary way. It's not an ordinary thing. Now, because the lot has this ability, the lot came to signify destiny, a discovery of the divine plan, which generally occurs through the simple unfolding of providence. In other words, Proverbs 16, 5 and 6, "The Lord is a portion of mine inheritance and of my cup. Thou maintainest my lot. The lines are fallen unto me in pleasant places. Yea, I have a goodly heritage." But it's used to prognosticate, which was often used in conjunction with astrological calculations, was strictly forbidden to the people of God. So in Leviticus 19:26, people of God are told, "You shall not eat anything with the blood, neither shall you use enchantment, nor observe times." Indeed, we know that this practice of casting lots and using it, particularly in conjunction with astrology, was a very common practice among the heathen, and it's condemned to the people of God. Isaiah 47, 13 and 14, "Thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. Behold, they shall be as stubble. Fire shall burn them. They shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There shall not be a coal to warm at, nor fire to sit before it." So it's a heathen practice, and it's condemned in the people of God and to the people of God. And yet there is a legitimate use from time to time. But Haman's use here is clearly not legitimate. He's doing it in conjunction with astrology, and his purposes are not very noble ones, are they? So the first month, that is the month Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month. And these words suggest then that Haman himself is not the one casting the lots, but that they were cast before him by some other person. Now that might seem a little strange at first glance, but if we consider his very elevated status at this point, it's a near certainty that Haman has an entire cadre of courtiers who are devoted to his service. They're going to do whatever he wants them to do. And amongst them, because he is a member of this caste of magi, it is to be supposed, I think, that there would be several whose particular office concerned divination. Probably not going to be a magi and want to be in that position and not have some people around you who also are part of that same caste. So it's very likely this kind of divination was a peculiar office of one kind of soothsayer or another that he had around him. Language of day to day and from month to month has engendered some debate. Some commentators think that Haman was casting lots to find a proper date upon which to present his petition to the king for the wholesale destruction of the Jewish people. And I don't think that's entirely misguided, especially if we have reason to suspect that this is part of the problem, perhaps, that Ahasuerus had. He had neglected to do this before he set out his purpose. But most commentators think he's actually trying to determine the best day upon which to execute these purposes. And that is, in fact, I think, the point that is most clear in our text. So although I suppose it might have been with an eye to both, we probably have to consider the second as being more more appropriate to understanding this. Nonetheless, as I say, Haman certainly perceived from the beginning his need of divine guidance if he's going to curse the people of God. And the guidance that he's seeking may very well have begun with seeking the most propitious time to present his petition to the king. Of course, it clearly ended with seeking the fixing of a date for consigning the Jews to total destruction. And so that's why I think we have to consider it most apropos. The language most properly then indicates that the lots were cast first for determining a day and then for a month. Now, while the day is not mentioned in this verse, it seems from verse 13 and some of the following verses here in this chapter that the day fixed was, in fact, the 13th day of the month. Daddy. Having determined the day, it only really remained to cast for the month. And as the lots fell upon the various months, it finally came to a rest, which is noted in the next part of this verse. Right, so they're casting per, that is the lot, before Haman from day to day and from month to month, to the 12th month, that is the month Adar. In other words, what this means is it's the 12th month that was taken in the lot. They're casting and the 12th month is taken. Now, the author adds its Babylonian name, Adar, which corresponds to our mid-February to mid-March. And it's the zodiacal sign of Mahek, or Pisces, the fish. And interestingly enough, because of what we know is going to happen here, the symbol for this time of year represents one who stands as a mediator between two realities, usually between death and life. Now, the Jews, we need to understand, the Jews believed that when God created the world, he set up a plan. They thought of it as sort of a blueprint of all of the things which would occur in the world. And it was believed by many of the ancient people, including the Jews, even though it was forbidden to them, that this blueprint could actually be accessed through astrology, which would give a knowledge of the future. And so it was thought to give great power to someone to know how to read the stars and how to put all of that information together. The Magi, then, were of all men noted for their grasp of this hidden knowledge. And yet, I want you to contemplate this. Haman still manages to choose a date that we know, if we've read the whole book, we know it portends his own downfall. Now, the rabbis have suggested that in this case, God has actually changed what he had written in order to overturn the plans of Haman. In other words, they say, well, they read it right, but God just changed the plan. And of course, that, I think, is one of the stupid remarks that the rabbis make from time to time, because it suggests that God can change his mind or needs to change his mind. They actually have a more interesting and suggestive line on this, and that is, they believe that when Haman cast lots and saw that the lot fell upon Adar, the 12th month, that he actually began to rejoice. And that he was rejoicing because he knew that Moses had died in the month of Adar. And so they say, Haman concluded that Israel's strength would be most diminished in that month. So for him, this looks fortuitous, right? This looks like a good sign that this is falling in the month that Moses died. However, as the rabbis note, Adar was also the month in which Moses was born. And therefore, they understood Israel's position actually to be strengthened and not weakened by this month. Now, this observation, as the reader of the book of Esther knows, is certainly the case. And yet the date is most significant because it casts the date of the destruction of the Jews to the last month of the year. If you think about what he's doing, he's looking to cast and find a date somewhere in the year. He really couldn't have found any time much later in the year than he does, the 13th day of the last month of the year. That's barely going to leave you enough time to destroy everyone in that year. But knowing what we know, since they were in the first month, this actually gave Israel time to hear of their predicament, to repent of their predicament, and thereby see the decree for their destruction annulled. Furthermore, it gave allowance for time to send out a new decree after the first had been annulled. And that couldn't have happened if the time frame had been too short. Additionally, the lengthening of time gave the Jews time to prepare to resist and defeat their enemies at the appointed time. And of course, all of this because the whole disposing of the lot is truly of the Lord. So verse 8. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it's not for the king's profit to suffer them. And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus. Haman now, think about this, Haman believes he has secret knowledge. He believes this is the knowledge he needs to convince the king. He thinks he has everything he needs. He's totally prepared now to go before the king. The king as yet knew nothing of Haman's scheming. But now Haman has an argument which he believes has been derived from the cosmic blueprint discovered through astrology and the casting of lots. Now, one commentator rightly notes here that though he might begin his speech before the king saying something such as, the stars do not lie, nonetheless, he is lying and trying to entrap the king into following his vicious plan against the people of God. It's notable, actually, here in this verse, what he says as well as what he doesn't say. In the Midrash on this verse, they actually give what they believe to be the full text of this speech. But this verse actually contains more than enough to show us the bias and the hatred that is emanating from Haman. Now, the Midrash says that Haman was the greatest expert in Lashon Hara. And what makes a person expert in Lashon Hara is the ability to take anything that anyone says or does and turn it into something dishonorable and potentially criminal. And that's exactly what Haman does. Every act of their religious devotion and their civil righteousness is twisted and contorted and turned into an indictable offense by Haman in this verse. He said there's a certain people. Literally, the verse, the Hebrew says, there is one people. Haman immediately separates those targeted by his petition from all other people. They are one people. One people. They're definable and they're identifiable. Of course, he conveniently does not name them, because if he named them, the king might remember something good about them. He might recall some kind of good that they had done, or more importantly, he might think about Esther. He might actually know that she is a Jew. And when he's given a full description, he might conclude that she belongs to this people. And so Haman's spin removes from view all possibility of thinking better of this people, because they are, for now, going to remain nameless. You know, sometimes it is an unbiased thing to remove someone's name when you're describing what they've done. But sometimes it's actually the most biased thing you can do, because you decontextualize what was done and you don't allow anyone to take into account the bigger picture. This is Lashon Hara. There's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom. The rabbis present these things as answers to several hypothetical questions. So they understood it to run something like this. They understood Haman to be saying to the king something like this. If thou sayest, well, I'm going to make a bare spot in my kingdom. You know, that is, if I destroy all these Jews, I'll make a bare spot in my kingdom. I reply, they're scattered. If thou, that is, if the king says, we have advantage by them, I reply, they live separately, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, among the races, and they're unproductive. If thou sayest they live in one country, I reply, they're in all the provinces of thy kingdom. Okay? Now, whether or not that's actually going on, as the Midrash is indicating, certainly what Haman is saying here is, again, Lashon Hara. Because scattered refers to the diaspora, which began at the time of the Babylonian captivity. It reaches its greatest height during the time of the Greek kingdom. The Jews were dispersed throughout the vast range of the Persian Empire. The word translated dispersed actually should be understood here to mean separated. Right? What it means is these people are scattered and they have remained unassimilated into the general population. Right? They're here, but they won't assimilate. And they're everywhere. They're scattered everywhere. Now, this is rightly, in my judgment, been taken to mean that they have erected a law barrier in order to prevent themselves from being absorbed by the heathen. And that actually is in keeping with the commandments of God. Deuteronomy 4, verses 5 through 8. Behold, I've taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land whither you go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great, who hath God so nigh unto them, as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great, that hath statutes and judgments so righteous, as all this law which I set before you this day? They're unassimilated, but they're unassimilated for a very good reason. And yet, Lashon Hara, Haman is taking this very thing, which should be a matter of, viewed as admirably as a matter of religious devotion and even civil righteousness, and he's twisting and turning it into an indictable offense. Then he continues. They're scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Now, this is a true charge, right? It's true. I just read they were supposed to do this, Deuteronomy 4. But that should have been actually of no effect in the eyes or the ears of the king, because it was the custom of the Persians, actually, to allow any conquered people to retain their own laws and usages, as long as they didn't get in the way of the sovereign in any major way. However, Haman is suggesting these people are different because, unlike most people that are conquered by the Persians, they don't stay in one place, in their own ghetto, as it were. They're spread everywhere. They're in every province of the kingdom. Everything they do, Haman is suggesting then, is to be suspect since they're not being assimilated. This is Lashon Hara. The rabbis go on to say that Haman actually told the king that the Jews had more respect for a fly than for the king. And here's how he reasoned, according to them. If a fly fell into a Jew's cup of wine, they would pick out the fly and drink the wine. However, if the king touched a Jew's wine cup, they would refuse to drink it and they would pour out all the wine. And that's true. They would do that. Because it would be considered unclean if it was touched by a Gentile. They had to observe kosher laws. Furthermore, it's noted in the Midrash that they were accused in their non-assimilation. Part of the accusation was they wouldn't marry heathens, they wouldn't celebrate the heathen festivals and things of that nature. Now, all of these things actually ought to be to their praise, and it ought to be considered a matter of genuine religious devotion. They shouldn't be criticized or certainly not indicted. These should not be indictable offenses. But he goes on. There's certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people. Neither keep they the king's laws. Now here is the real crux of Haman's argument wrapped in a half-truth. Again, Lashon Hara. The Jews, he's saying, would keep those laws of the king. Not at all. Right? Except that's not true. The fact is, the Jews would keep any laws of the king which were moral or orderly without any complaint, so long as they were not in any way impinging upon the observance of the true religion. So there might have been an occasional edict here or there which they didn't obey, like the one that Mordecai isn't obeying, but Haman presents this as a pattern of continued disobedience. And what he's actually arguing is that their adherence to the true religion is the cause of disobeying the king. Again, in arguing in this manner, what Haman is really speaking of is the case of Mordecai with respect to himself, without any other proof or example. He doesn't have anything else that he can point to at this time, at least. Otherwise, he would. Therefore, he concludes, therefore it's not for the king's prophet to suffer them. It's not for the king's prophet. It's not fitting for the king to leave such a people unmolested. Right? These are troubling people. These are people that are troubling your kingdom. It's not true, but he's taken one example, the example of Mordecai. It's not all the Jews that aren't bowing down, by the way, because so many of them, as we've seen previously in this book, so many of them have assimilated, at least to a certain degree, and have given in to the idolatry around them. Mordecai is an exception. But the Magi, this Magus, Haman, he knows that this is a fight between two different worldviews, two non-compatible religious points of view. So their religious views make them a threat to the Persian way of life, and they shouldn't be suffered to remain amongst the Persian people. That's the gist of Haman's argument here. Now, this really is Lashon Hara. Because the very things that Haman raises, as I've said, are all of them matters of obeying the Lord. In fact, God has set his love upon his people precisely in order to bring them to this kind of obedience that is forming the basis for this accusation that Haman is raising. The accuser of the brethren here is raising these objections, which are objections really to the commands of God, if you're a true believer. In fact, all of these things being in Israel by the grace of God are signs of grace. They're not actions that would call forth divine judgments. And so he's really arguing against the right. He's arguing against God's commands. He thinks he's arguing merely against the Jews, but he's actually arguing with God here. It's not entirely different from Balak and Balaam. Remember, Balak goes to Balaam and says, you know, I want you to curse Israel for me. I'll pay you a lot of money. And he can never do it. You know, the same thing here with the Lot. The Lot, they think it's going to curse Israel, but it doesn't happen that way. But Haman doesn't stop there. He goes on to say, if it please the king, this is in verse 9, if it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business to bring it into the king's treasuries. If it please the king. Now this is actually the proper manner of petitioning the king. This is Haman may be excited, may be anxious to achieve his end, but Haman also knows he cannot force the hand of the king. And I think it's just as a moment of point of reflection here, we should ask ourselves, how much more should we show deference when we address the King of all kings with our petitions, if someone as wicked as Haman knows to do so in the presence of a heathen king like Ahasuerus or Xerxes? If it please the king, he says, let it be written. Now, Haman is seeking an edict, a written declaration, putting into effect his design. And the reason is, if you remember, by putting it in writing, it becomes an unalterable decree. Remember in Esther 1, verse 19, if it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered. So he knows if he can get this in writing, it will not be able to be removed from the law books. It has to stay. Please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. Now, again, I want to point out, Lashon Hara, right? Haman has still not named this people whom he's described. He wishes their destruction without any consideration being given to their true worth or value. He still doesn't want the king to know who it is of whom he's speaking. And yet his call is for complete annihilation, because the word that's used here is really indicating that he wants them wiped out. There's not even room here for somebody to be kept so much as for slaves. And he wants them destroyed, utterly destroyed. Now, undoubtedly, this would have been somewhat startling to the king, who has only just now become aware of the problem outlined by Haman. And had he had his way, he might have desired some time to think on the matter. And if he had begun to think on the matter too long, he might have asked some questions that would have unraveled the whole plot that Haman is hatching here. But before any of these things could occur, Haman immediately sets forth an offer. This is, if it pleases the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business. Now, this is a great bribe that he's offering here. I mean, and when I say great, I don't mean great in the sense of wonderful. I mean great in the sense it's a huge amount of money. The ancient historian Herodotus tells us that early in the reign of Xerxes, Xerxes had been offered money for a consideration that would have been valued around $6 billion today. Somebody wanted Xerxes to do something and offered him about $6 billion. And Xerxes declined it because the coffers of his treasuries were full. But you have to remember, that was before his ill-fated campaign against Greece. Now Haman offers something in the range of about $4 billion. And the difference between having full treasuries and empty treasuries makes Haman's offer quite attractive. I don't know if these numbers are exactly accurate. I've seen different numbers. Some say it's closer to $5 billion is the equivalent of what Haman is offering. But it has been estimated that what Haman is offering is the equivalent of 2/3 of the annual revenues of the empire, just to destroy the Jews. So it shouldn't come as any surprise then that Ahasuerus is moved by such an offer. I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business. Those with the charge of the business, by the way, doesn't mean those who he intended to make the slaughter. He's talking about those who are entrusted with keeping the royal treasuries, as you see at the end of the verse, to bring it into the king's treasuries. So these monies are going to be handed over to those who are entrusted with paying it into the treasuries of the king. That's the point here. Now, we don't have time to get into much more, and so I'm going to conclude with just a couple of brief observations. In all of this, we see the providence of God very clearly. And we see, in fact, that there's a trap that's being laid for the people of God, and it's well set. Haman has actually done everything about as well as you can imagine in laying out a trap. You know, and he's even petitioned the king in a very interesting way. He slandered the people of God, brought these indictable offenses, Lashon Hara, and then he's really sweetened the deal at the end by not giving the king any time to think about it, but just offering a huge sum of money. You know, let's move on. These are bad people, and here's a lot of money. Let's do something about it. So the plan, the trap, is offered up from a principle of hatred. He's full of wrath. It's argued with a series of lies. And it's seasoned with a whole lot of money to entice the avarice or the greed of men, particularly the king. And these are always the kind of tools that are employed by the wicked to get what they want. However, we have already been advertised of the presence of the divine in the casting of the lots. Haman may think that all of this is going well, but even the enemies of the people of God are going to be constrained to admit that our God reigneth over all for the good of his people at the end of this story. Haman may have laid one of the most thorough, reaching plots or devices against the people of God ever devised. He may have laid a trap that is the most thorough. And yet, at every point in his laying of the trap, there's already an answer, because he's kicking against the pricks. He's trying to attack the people of God not for their sin, but for their obedience. And he's trying to bribe a king to destroy the people of God, not because they've sinned against God or even done anything against the king. It's a principle of his own covetousness that's at work here. It's his own hatred that's moving the king. And it's his own hatred that has positioned him against the people of God. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but are mighty to the pulling down of strongholds. And that's what we're going to see as the story continues to unfold and we watch all of Haman's devices come tumbling down. The wicked will not prevail. God's plan will prevail. And the righteous will prevail over the wicked in the end. And that's the story of Esther. Amen.